who's your favourite 10 to play with up in Ulster?
Oh, Jesus. I'm going to say Ian, obviously, but Billy Byrne's very emotional. He'd be heartbroken to where he'd come in and make me feel bad. So I'll just say it was Christian Leofano when he was here and he's gone.
Yeah.
House of Rugby Ireland, here on Joe, together with Guinness. Game changed.
Hello and welcome along to House of Rugby Ireland here on Joe and together with Guinness. I'm Eimear Considine and I am joined as always by Ian Madigan. It's episode 15 and we have had some amazing guests on so far and today it is no different. Ian, take it away. I'll let you give the honours of introducing this guy.
Yeah, John Cooney, Guinness Pro 14 winner with Leinster, Connacht and soon to be Ulster. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's interesting having you on the other side of the mic.
Yeah, slightly different, all right. But we'll get straight into it, John. What did you make of the game last night? Obviously, not the result we wanted up in Ulster with Leinster getting another win.
Yeah, I think it's the first time I've ever been up for Munster in a rugby game. I think we grew up not really being the biggest fan of them, and from playing them, there's always a lot of niggle, so can't say I really support them, but I was gutted to see them lose at the end, I thought. Probably for the first 60 minutes, they're really in command, and a few things didn't go their way. Just the turn of rugby and the way Leinster always grind out at half time for that 6-point turn, it always looked like it might come back and bite them at the end. But it was disappointing for us, and fair play to Leinster coming back, so scored a serious try.
Yeah, Eimear is a big Munster supporter. Like, what's the feeling, in the camp there? Obviously, it's a tough one to take.
Like, I can't imagine how they feel, like, whatever it is about being a supporter, but imagine waking up today, like, knowing that you were definitely the better team. Leinster played probably for 10 minutes of that game and just did typical Leinster, like, scored a try out of, it was a great, Munster's defence had been so good all day that it forced Leinster to try something like a kick in behind, and, like, only Leinster would it work out for, like, the way it did. Waking up this morning and I went on Instagram, the first thing that I saw was Leinster rugby put up, like that winning feeling or something, like the next morning. Can you imagine how the boys are feeling? Like, as a supporter, I'm gutted for them. So not to talk about as a player waking up knowing, you're always worse the next morning as well. Like, if you lose after a game, you feel 10 times worse. The body is 10 times worse. You feel every ache more the day after a game. So I imagine they're feeling every bit of that game from last night. But, so disappointing. So disappointing knowing that, like, Munster we're the better team. And, like, even Tadhg Byrne chatting after the game, like, you could see the disappointment in him. And, like, what more could he have done? Like, what more could Tadhg Byrne have done? And there were so many of the boys out there, what more could they have given out on the field?
Yeah, certainly. You could see with the Munster back row, like, I thought Pete, CJ, Ty, they were all brilliant last night, came up with some good turnovers. The Munster defence was unbelievable on their line. And I thought it was very good throughout the game. But ultimately, for me, what killed them was giving away stupid, unnecessary penalties around the middle of the pitch when, their defensive line is set. It wasn't like Leinster were really going forward or had Munster under big pressure, and they'd give away a penalty for coming offside or not rolling away. And, while Leinster didn't punish them, unduly once they got into their 22, it just, it still added up to 3 points, 6 points. And then even, the last try, like, it came from, a silly offside penalty from the middle of the pitch when the team's not under pressure. Suddenly, Leinster get a line out on the 22, execute a good set-piece play. Granted, they get a small bit of luck, but they've made their own luck there. It's a tactical kick that they've put in where they know there's a bit of space. And it was really well finished. And, suddenly they hold out for the last 10 minutes and it's game over. And it does feel like a bit of a robbery, but at the same time, I think Leinster will say, look, we just hung in there, and when it counted, we came up with the goods.
I suppose the difference is, obviously at the end of the day, you have to score more on the scoreboard, but Munster didn't score for 71 minutes. They, you know, against a team like Leinster, you have to be taking every opportunity. And I know JJ is getting a lot of stick about missing those kicks. And it wasn't just that, you know, there was other turning points in the game, like those penalties, silly penalties being given away. You know, the kicks did not help. It would have put Munster in a really good position going in at halftime. Like instead of going in 10-6, they would have gone in 13-3. You know, it would have been halftime and a completely different game in the second half. So I suppose, like, not to put the blame on JJ, like, it isn't. There's, like, Byrne knocked on a ball at the end, Yolandi knocked on a ball at the end. You know, these are just turning points. Even the kick that hit the post, you know, the pens that was given away straight away after that, like, you know, unnecessary. So a lot of it was in Munster's hands at the end of the day. But I suppose as kickers, the two of you, John, like, what? Like, how do you bounce back from, like, do you think the blame, like, as a kicker, do you take that blame on you? Like, do you see that as your fault as a kicker?
No, and I actually probably would have been in defence of JJ. Yes, missing that kick. I've missed that kick, I think, three times maybe over the last couple of years. Actually, a bit of a bogey kick for me personally, because it's just sliding to your right side. And if you don't commit to it, you can easily miss it. I missed it in the quarterfinal against Leinster. And in the past, I've messaged him after last year saying to keep the head up, because it is difficult. I think you're right. I think people forget about the penalty Rhys Marshall gave away or the penalty for offside, and people kind of put all the blame on him. So I was straight to defend him, and if people had gone after him, I probably would have went online to defend him. Because as a kicker, you don't lose games. I don't think you win games as well. I think people put you in those positions to win it, and me and Ian will put ourselves under pressure to get the kicks. But it's kind of like sport. It's so fickle. You can't really get ahead of yourself when you get them all, because you know when you miss, people are going to kind of blame you for it. So I've learned over the last few years to try not to get ahead of myself either way. So yeah, I felt bad for him in that, and I know I think he's probably up there as possibly the best kicker in the country, bar Ian. So yeah,
if you'd ever let me kick, Johnny.
For people to blame him, they seem to forget how well he kicked all season, and they did it last year as well. Yes. So I think it's harsh.
No, I'd agree with that. I think if you look at the game, you know, the first kick that he's taken on, like, that's a big kick in cold weather. The ball doesn't travel anything as far. Hits a great one from, you know, close to 50 metres. The one before half time, for me, is a really good kick. He's ended up hitting the inside of the post. It's, you know, an inch from going over. And I'd have big qualms with that one in the second half. The penalty was given away bang in front of the post. You know, it's a tap over. And wherever it was ended up being awarded, because the phase of play went on four or five phases, the ref for me has picked the wrong spot out. And, you know, you go from a kick that's 100% he's going to get it to suddenly it's probably an 85, 90%. He's lifted his head a small bit maybe early and he's just pushed it. And, you know, they're the fine margins. It's a different game when they go 7 points up there. And, you know, even you're putting Ross under different kind of pressure. He's got a kick to draw the game up as opposed to go 3 points further ahead. And at the same time, credit to him, like, that was a cracking kick, and it makes the last 7-8 minutes a very different game.
That's the thing. I think people forget, if he didn't get that first kick, it's a different, like, people seem to forget that was a really good kick. So he could have easily missed that kick to then get the second one. It's the exact same scenario. So for him to nail that first kick, I think people forget that later on in the game.
Yeah, look, JJ is not top point scorer for no reason. Like, and it's annoying that people, you know, it's easy to look at the kicker and say, oh, that's the reason they lost. And I suppose when you dig deeper, there's the penalties, there's the missed tackles, there's, you know, the Leinster flair, and they're the real reasons that, you know, I think Munster are blaming even a crooked line out. But like, you just have to move on. Like, the rest doesn't call it, you just play it. Do you think so?
I don't know. I don't know what the touch judge is watching there.
The good thing is there was good positives there for Munster. Like, I thought they had more variation in their game last night. You know, they ran the forwards around the corner, running that kind of block play. You know, they send a forward short, another forward out the back, getting their nine running. It just created indecision in that Leinster defensive line. And, you know, they make, you know, 2, 3, 5, you know, 7, 8 metres. And they got their game going really well. They got the ball to width well, especially in the first half. You know, there's much more for them to build on with their game now. And compared to how downbeat everyone was after the semi-final last year, you know, it was kind of a feeling of, Jesus, where are Munster going to go from here? You know, there was questions about what Larkin was doing with the backs. There was no creativity. Whereas off the back of that performance last night, you know, they know that they can compete with the very best. And, you know, there is definitely a buzz building down in Limerick and Cork.
I think personally, there's a lot of good standout performances from Munster. I think Mike Haley was phenomenal in 15 and his kicks. I don't know whether they were luck or whether it was just a bounce of a ball, but, you know, to pin Leinster back in within inches of the try line, you know, it's some really great kicking. But also Conor Murray had a great game. I think we have to, I suppose, as a nine, John, you'd appreciate the performance of Murray last night.
Yeah, I thought that's the best I've seen him play in a while. I thought he had a good mix of his running game and his kicking. And something he's always probably the best in the world at doing is box kicking, and I think he kicked really well. I thought Leinster, surprisingly, in the second half against us a week ago, we got a lot of purchase in the first half, and in the second half they started shielding us really well on the way back, whereas I was surprised in the second half against Munster they didn't really get it together, whereas, as I said, the week before they did. So Munster got a lot of purchase on Larmer kicking, and I think they used it well. The only thing that worried me about Munster's performance was the last 5 minutes when they did need to score and they kept box kicking. And I think when Casey came on, they boxed it 3 or 4 times. So I would have liked to see them try to run the ball a bit, because Munster were kicking a little bit too long to Haley. I thought they'd just get Haley, take it up quickly, and then play to the width. So that's the only thing that probably worried me about Munster in the last 5 minutes, similar to the semi-final last year where they needed points and they didn't know really what to do at the end.
Yeah, like Casey's obviously been very good for Munster this season, and, you know, he's a quality player, but he came on and he's probably overcooked, you know, definitely 3 box kicks that should have been contestable. And, you know, the one that he does get up contestable, Munster do very well to win it back. But I think they're the fine margins that you need from your bench coming on. You know, you need 3 out of 4 of them to be accurate, you know, especially when you're going into the final 7 or 8 minutes of a game and it's all on the line. It's a 2-3 point game.
So going forward here, I suppose, looking like Munster did Ulster no favours really last night. You know, you were big Munster fans last night and rightly so. You know, you're still sitting on top of Conference A, but, you know, where now, like, how much pressure are Ulster on right now just going forward, or like how much did you need Leinster to lose that game last night, Ian?
Well, I think for us, it doesn't change a whole lot. Like, Leinster were going to have to come up to Kingspan, and we were going to have to beat them regardless. You know, if we didn't beat them, we weren't going to make the final, simple as. Whereas now it just puts us under a bit of pressure. It means we've got to keep winning our other games with bonus points to beat Leinster to stay ahead. Whereas, you know, a couple of weeks ago, even if it was 4-1 in points in the RDS, it would have meant that if we'd beaten them in Ravenhill, it would have been signed, sealed and delivered, you know, that we would have been the top of our conference. But I also think as well, the way things are going, I think it's very unusual, it's very unlikely that the Rainbow Cup will go ahead. So I think what will probably happen is it will just be a standard league season. We'll play everyone home and away. It will be the standard semi-final. You know, the team that comes first in Conference A plays the team that comes second in Conference B. So there's still going to be another, I think, 12 or 13 games to go. So plenty of rugby to be played, and I'm sure there'll be plenty of turns as the season goes on.
I suppose everything at the moment is so up in the air with fixtures and that. And look, if the Rainbow Cup doesn't go ahead, do you think they'll just revert back to the normal Guinness Pro 14 format?
Yeah, I was going to make that point, what Ian said there. It's so uncertain at the moment whether that will go ahead. So it is quite difficult to know whether we're fighting to top the league or not. And it's probably a cliche that you say you take each game as it comes, but it's hard to sit at home and do that sometimes. So, I don't know when we are going to find out. It's probably all just down to COVID and restrictions. And we know in Northern Ireland, we're definitely in it till March. So I'd say it's highly unlikely that we'll be going to South Africa for the new season. So it's kind of just wait and see. It's probably been like that for the last year and a bit now. So it's probably the new normality for us as human beings up here.
It's like, get you really excited about this really cool new tournament that's going to happen and then just take it all away from you. How's you guys both are on, you've had a 5-week break from games. Well, you'd have a 5-week break in total. So how hard is it to stay motivated at the moment, you know, without a game, you know, next week or the week after? You know, what's your target and what's your focus at the moment, John?
Yeah, I'm still waiting to see what happens with the Irish squad. I think it's named tomorrow, so I'm either getting a phone call tonight to tell me I'm not, or I'll find out probably tomorrow. So that would definitely give me some inspiration to keep going. Otherwise, I'd be lying to say it would be a little bit difficult to stay motivated for the next 4 weeks. But luckily, I'm quite vain. So I'll probably try to stay in the gym and keep the body moving. So yeah, I do find it hard not to train. My problem is I've probably learned in the last few years to stop training, because three shoulder surgeries at a young age probably taught me a lesson. So I enjoy doing my own training and stuff. I like staying out of Ulster when I don't have to be in there and go to my garage or go do whatever I like to do. So I'm sure I'll find some sort of inspiration, something to keep me going.
So we'll get on to the current season with Ulster in, I suppose, the next few weeks, and hopefully a call up, John. Hopefully you'll get that. No, you won't get that phone call and that you'll end up getting the email or whatever it is. But just wanted to start off with, this was you and Ian both played together at Leinster. And take us way back, and I suppose, what memories do you have of playing with Leinster and playing with Ian?
I actually was only thinking of this on my walk there. My first memory, well, I played with them all underage, but I got called up to the Irish 20s year young. I was quite loose. I don't know what I was thinking, but I came on. I went for a drop goal. The only time I've ever gone from a drop goal at scrum half. So we had a penalty. I just took a drop goal from the bottom of the ruck, missed it. I think Ian then got the kick, went back, went to throw the ball for him to kick the ball. And I just remember seeing his face. I threw the pass and it was so high over his head that he just looked at, like, oh crap. He started running back like 15 meters because I threw the ball so far over his head. And luckily he cleared it. And the next day, Alan Clark calls me and drops me from the squad.
I remember that. That was in Athlone, wasn't it? Oh, God, yeah, that was 20s games.
Oh, crap. You know when you can, like, jump up and catch it there, but you're just like, oh, this is so far over my head, I can't even do it.
Yeah, it certainly has. Those under 20 campaigns down in Athlone, like, there was just it definitely suited my second year at 20s. You know, we had a very good pack, and you know, playing on that pitch was such a leveler. Like, we had the French and the English coming over, who great back lines, and you know, suddenly they're running in effectively like a marsh pit. But it's a very different surface to what they're playing in Donnybrook now. Like, it's a much faster surface. And it probably suits the you know, the Irish under 20s now, the way they're being coached and the way they've played the last few years. But I know, whatever, 10 years ago, it definitely suited us as a bit of a leveler, and we got some good results out of it.
Yeah, definitely. And then I remember us both on the bench for the final of the European Cup. I remember, for me, that was just an incredibly bizarre week. I remember I was about third choice, and I remember on the Tuesday, I looked around and Owen Redden and Isaac Boss were both down with injuries. I was like, oh crap. I was like, I better know all these plays that we need to know. And I remember having to go in and basically run with the starting team. And I'd never played in Europe. I only had four caps for Leinster. And then getting to the Thursday, the main training session, neither of them still training, and thinking, oh Jesus, I'm going to have to play here. And then where it got to the Friday, so the captain's run day, Isaac Boss told me he'd be fine. So I was up the night before till like 12:30 with Dominic Ryan just messing around and assuming I wouldn't be playing, to then in the warm-up have Joe Schmidt sprinting over to me telling me that I'm on the bench. So that was bizarre. I remember coming on with you and being really relaxed for some reason, because I just thought it was such a big game that I can't really come on and do badly. And I remember the two of us came on and just threw the ball around, and I'd also hadn't played in 6 weeks. So I'd lost like 5 kilos because I'd broken my jaw. So I went from playing for against UL Bows for Lansdowne in the AAL to then playing my first game in Europe in the Heineken Cup final. So it was a crazy couple of weeks then.
Like, as young guys coming on, I can't remember the score when we came on. We were probably about 10 points up, but you know, the game was broken at that stage. And Ulster were running on fumes, and we came on, got some nice set pieces, and just were able to throw the ball around, kind of put the icing on the cake. You know, and you feel like, at the time, I remember thinking, Jesus, this is so easy. Like, you know, we were both probably thinking we were going to go on to win 10 European Cups and 10 league trophies, you know, because the following week we played in the league final, which we actually, neither of us got on. And it was kind of an unusual game. We'd spent the week kind of celebrating winning Europe, and you know, I think we all thought we had Ospreys' number, and they came over and, in fairness to us, put in a really good performance. think Dan Beer got a kick from the touchline to beat us in, you know, pretty much the last play of the game. But at the time, you're thinking, oh, well, at least we won. Not the end of the world. Roll on to next season. You're pretty wet behind the ears.
Never misses a game. But obviously, because I didn't think I'd actually play in the final, I told her she was flying to Spain. And she's like, oh, well, I cancel my flight to Spain. I was like, oh, no, don't, just go. I won't be playing. And while I got on, because I, as I said, I only got told I was playing in the warm-up, she was flying. And when she landed, she obviously found out I played and everything. And she was heartbroken. And I don't think for 3 weeks she'd do anything I asked her. If I ever wanted food, anything made, she'd be straight over dinner for me. So she was heartbroken because she literally would go to every game and she couldn't believe she missed it because she didn't even get to see it. So, yeah, poor woman.
Your poor mother. But going back to that call-up, that game, you know, Joe Schmidt obviously, you know, backed you to be good enough to be on the bench or even start. You know, obviously injuries were the main reason that you were there, but obviously you were good enough to be there as well. And Joe Schmidt has gone down like in history books and is a legendary coach. And I suppose he was there at the start of your career with Leinster and then at the end with your Ireland career. And like, how did your relationship change from the beginning to the end of that, really?
Yeah, well, I think we always got on. It's just, I think sometimes probably having him young probably worked out badly in my favor in terms of back then I was probably pretty relaxed in terms of probably slightly naive. I wouldn't have been one to be big into watching training, being real precise with knowing all the plays, stuff like that. I kind of more relied on just playing rugby and kind of getting away with probably practicing a lot and being decent footballer. So something that definitely later on in my career now and stuff, I'd make sure I know all my plays inside out and make sure I don't make mistakes like that. But I found maybe that kind of pigeonholed me sometimes in terms of anything I did wrong would probably be overemphasized, whereas things I do right probably would just kind of go under the radar and stuff like that. So it probably worked badly in my favor, I'd say, having them quite young for that reason. But also having them young was unbelievable for certain habits. I could always hear him screaming when I wasn't working hard enough to get back off kicks and stuff like that. So he definitely gave me a lot of good traits as a young player, and probably having him young was a blessing for me as a rugby player. So, I don't know why I probably didn't get picked as much, but it was disappointing to not make that World Cup squad. And that's probably the last time I talked to him. And probably for the first time in 8 or 9 years, I told him how I felt and thought I should have been in there longer anyway than getting cut quite early. But as I said, fond memories of having him as a coach early days, and he gave me a lot of good habits.
Do you think that he pigeonholed you, like as an older player, he just remembered you as that young player that he had once coached in Leinster, and anytime, you know, he thought about you, he thought of you as young John Cooney, you know, young John Cooney who didn't know his plays in that?
Yeah, I think I probably what played here now for rugby for about 10 years, and Ian and yourself are probably the same. I think sometimes coaches are going to have a narrative and a thought of you, and a lot of the time they're going to make everything that you do fit that narrative. So sometimes you could do 10 good things and one bad thing, and they'll probably only just remember the bad thing. So it can work the other way. You can have a coach that likes you and you can make mistakes and they don't even realize it. So I've just realized that I'm going to just try and do what I do and what suits best for me. And as I have Matt O'Connor in the past, a coach who didn't rate me. And then I've Dan here who lets me express myself. So same with Pat Lam, he let me express myself. So you never know what a coach is going to think of you. And one coach could love you and one coach could hate you. So I've just realized that just being myself and playing the way I like to play is going to get the best out of me. And hopefully a coach respects me for that.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, John, there. Like, you know, a coach has to justify his selection every week. You know, there's going to be a coach's meeting between the backs coach, the attack coach, the D coach, the director rugby, whatever. Like, and they're going to just be discussing, you know, probably 25, 30 players that are up for selection every week. And they're going to have to give an excuse. Why are we going with Connor instead of John? And, you know, if an easy one is there, I thought John did his own thing during the week in training, and then all the other coaches row in behind that. And before you know it, you kind of get tagged with that. It's very hard to shake those tags. Whereas, and similarly, when they're positive as well, like when, you know, when a coach steps up and says, oh, well, Connor stuck to the game plan really well in training this week, and then they all row in behind that. It's kind of infectious, and it can be very hard to change a coach's opinion of you. Like Dan McFarland, funny enough, was the forwards coach in my first year at under 20 level. So I was, you know, 18, fresh out of school. Didn't know a whole lot about the game other than school's rugby. And Eric Elwood was our coach. And, you know, Eric wanted to play a really kind of structured game plan. And I'd never really done that in school. You know, I'd always, you know, ran the ball from my own half, and we had a good back line underage. And that's all I really knew. I hadn't really been thought any other way to play the game. And ultimately, Eric would have thought that I was a player that did my own thing. And he would have heard that from Eric, and Dan would have believed it. So, you know, 10 years later, when I'm up in Ulster, and he's probably thinking, ah, Ian Madigan, he just does his own thing. But little does he know that, you know, I've been playing away for the last 10 years, and you learn a lot. You learn off different coaches, you learn off different players. And, you know, I think players do change over time. You know, I think you can definitely say, oh, that guy still makes the same mistakes, or he still has a tendency to do that. But good players will learn as they go along. And also, I think as well, the game changes, as you know, changes a huge amount, even in the space of a kind of 2 or 3 year period. You know, the game changes. Like, I remember looking back, I think we watched that European final together, and I was looking at it going, oh my God, it's just nothing as physical as it is now, you know. And I think that's something that you can, that can actually go against you when you have a coach who coach you when you're underage. And then, you know, rugby comes around in full circles and you have them again.
Absolutely. And John, like you spoken before, like you mentioned Matt O'Connor there, but you've spoken before about Matt O'Connor and that decision to leave Leinster and go on loan to Connacht. Like, you know, you have to make the best decision for you. And I suppose that loan period was really beneficial for you as a player and for your development as a player.
Yeah. I still remember when he called me. I took him words. He kind of rang me and was like, oh, I was due to get surgery on my shoulder. So he made it out like it would be good for me to go. But I felt like he was just getting rid of me. But it actually worked out that my mum's from between Mayo and Sligo. So we have a house in Ballinagh. So I've always had a big connection with Connacht. So I was actually in Ballinagh when he called me. So it was a bit of a sign that I should probably do it. So originally when he did do it, I thought he was just getting rid of me and I was quite annoyed. But it kind of made sense to me to come back from injury and get up to Connacht and get some games. But these couple of years around then just seemed like I was bad luck, Brian. So basically the whole terms of it was to train with Leinster and do all my rehab. So I had to do it till September, which then meant that I was getting to Connacht when the season started. So therefore I was way behind. So when I got there, I didn't get my first cap till December. And it took me ages getting to the team. So then eventually I got a couple of games and started playing well. But I actually was the only player to get called back. So the whole terms was that any week they could call me back if they needed me. So I remember being in Dublin on a Sunday, in Dundrum Shopping Centre, getting a call off Guy Easterby to tell me I could be coming in the next day, which is obviously awkward because I had been in Connacht for like 5 months. And, you know, when you're a bit of a kind of outlier, you feel a bit awkward going back into a club you're not really playing for anymore. So I went in and I was getting new gym programs and stuff like that because nobody knew how long I was going to be back for. So I was just getting on with it or whatever. But it was actually probably the best training week I've ever had with Leinster because I didn't really care. I was like, well, I'm probably going back to Connacht anyway. So I was just calling myself and training, making breaks and stuff and enjoying it. And then I came on in the game. As I said, I didn't really care. I got the ball, rubbered it to the corner, and Dave Carney scores for us to go ahead. And then we actually lost the Dragons. We gave away a penalty at the end to lose. So I remember being in the changing rooms, happy with how it went. And Matt O'Connor just coming over going, yeah, you can go back to Connacht. I was like, okay, great. So went back to Connacht, played Dragons the week after again. So I'm the only player to play a team 2 weeks in a row. They were kind of looking at me beforehand. They're like, were you not playing us last week? Ended up having a good game, got man the match and stuff, and kind of kicked on then with Connacht to the end of that season. But the annoying thing was that they could still get me back. So Matt O'Connor then rang me saying that they might call me back. So I then texted him saying I don't want to come back because I just didn't see eye to eye with him. I didn't believe him that he rated me. So they actually offered me a 2-year contract, which I rang Joe Schmidt about to ask him what do you think was the best option for me. And he just said, wherever I'm happiest. So On the morning of it, I was going to re-sign with Leinster and change my mind in the morning, saying, no, I really like it in Connacht. This is where my friends are, and this is where I see kind of future for me. And on that morning, I changed my mind and stayed with Connacht, and the year after we won the league. So it was probably the best decision I made.
It's so funny that, like, when you're good, like, they really want you, and then he can just change his mind. And it was kind of a nightmare situation for you to be in, because, you know, if you played well, they'd want you back. But if you didn't play well, you know, they were happy to have you in Connacht. But it was good, I suppose, finally, that the decision ultimately lay in your own hands. And, well, it's worked out pretty well for you so far. And obviously that year winning with Connacht. And then bring us through your decision to move to Ulster. PNR was after leaving, and we had Darren Cave chat about him last week, and how much they, you know, almost mourned over losing him, and must have been a tough time. Well, like, you know, a great opportunity to go in and, you know, into that position, but big shoes to fill at the same time.
Yeah, that was the first joke I made. Was about, I said, sorry about the passing of Ruan, as in, because it felt like he died. But nobody got it. They thought I meant his bad passing, and it just went down so badly, and no one laughed. I just like, oh, this is a great first day. But yeah, it was interesting.
What else happened on your first day, Johnny?
I had an awful first day. I hated it. I was ready to go back to Connacht. I got told, so my first day, I met our fitness coach, who I knew, Kev Geary. And I've always been big into doing my extras. So I was like, oh, what gym can we go use? And he's like, we don't use another gym. You use this gym. I was like, oh, geez. Okay, that's not a good start. And then I was doing speed. And I was just trying to talk to people. And people were asking me questions. And I was just basically not concentrating the whole session. And the other fitness coach then pulled me aside after and giving out to me as well, telling me I need to concentrate. So I ended up having to text both of them at the end of the day, apologizing. But I also didn't have a house to live in, so I was sleeping on a mattress on the floor of a friend's brother's house. So it was just a bad first day. I was ready to get in the car and leave, probably.
Well, look, it's only gone up since there anyway with Ulster, and you seem to be really enjoying your rugby. Just one quick, really interesting question is, who is your favourite 10 to play with up in Ulster?
Oh, Jesus. I'm going to say Ian, obviously, but Billy Byrne's very emotional. He'd be heartbroken to where he'd come in and make me feel bad. So I'll just say it was Christian Leofano when he was here and he's gone.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the politician's answer there for sure. John, okay, exactly. It's time for the House of Rugby Challenge. So each week we ask our guests to talk about three items for us, and hopefully there's a nice story behind each of them. So the three pieces are a piece of rugby memorabilia, a jersey you have swapped and held on to, and something non-rugby that you treasure. So we'll start off with the piece of rugby memorabilia first.
You'll be surprised. Actually, like, football is probably a sport I prefer, so I've actually got football jerseys up, and I have a bit of a man cave upstairs. It's a bit grimy, but I have a couple of football framed jerseys. There's a Messi jersey framed, which is probably my prized possession up there. But I also got a jersey. This is probably the third question from, there's a basketballer, Isaiah Thomas, who used to play for the Boston Celtics. He's actually only small. He's like Ian's height. I think he's like 5'8" or something.
I'm taller than you.
I'm 6 foot. Are you joking?
You are not 6 foot.
Anyway, so during lockdown, I tagged Isaiah Thomas in a story or something, and he replied. And then another week later, I probably had too many whiskeys at home, and I messaged him going, are you keen for a jersey swap? Him probably not even knowing what rugby is. And he replied saying, yeah, I got you. And then I keep potholing him. I gave him my address, and about 2 months later, he sent me a signed Washington Wizards jersey, which I have framed up in that room. And it's unbelievable. I don't think he ever wanted my jersey, so I never sent it to him. I bought him a bottle of whiskey to say thanks. So that's probably my prized possession up there, just because if you don't know much about him, he's got a good documentary on YouTube, Book of Isaiah, where his sister actually passed away, and he played a basketball game the next day. And I just thought it was unbelievable, the kind of ability for him to do that the next day. And then they also went and traded him. So it's pretty tough watch and pretty heartbreaking. But he still works incredibly hard, and I took a lot of inspiration from him. So to have that jersey up in my room is pretty cool.
Yeah, really cool. So you kind of covered the piece, rugby memorabilia and the jersey that you swapped. And even if he didn't really want, even if he didn't want your jersey, which one did you send him?
I didn't send him one because I thought he wouldn't even want it, to be honest. He's a big dog and he wouldn't want some Irish rugby player to send him a jersey. But I do have a good jersey that I have kept on my first cap against Japan. And Michael Leach gave me his number 6 jersey. So that was pretty cool of him. And to not even take my jersey, he gave me his. So I have that in Dublin and soon to be framed. It's pretty cool to have the captain of Japan's jersey.
That's unreal. Yeah, really unreal. And what about something non-rugby that you treasure?
Non-rugby that I treasure. Michael Owen was my... Oh, sorry. Yeah, I was going to say my Michael Owen jersey, but it is the dog. Either way, my girlfriend's going to kick the crap out of me because she hates that Michael Owen jersey. And for me not to say the dog, she'd kill me. So I'd actually never had it. It's Claire's family dog, and she brought her up about a year ago. And when she first came up, I'd never had a dog. So I was like, oh, she's not up on the couch. She's not going to be up in the room with us. And now she literally sleeps at the bottom of her bed and she does anything she wants. So I've fully turned into one of those dog people, even set her up on Instagram, which I used to think was the lamest thing going. And now it's probably the highlight of my day is using her Instagram, and I probably don't use mine anymore. So I've become that crazy dog person. Maybe it's 2020 and lockdown, but I've become that lame person now.
If ever there was a year to do that, I think 2020 and 2021 it's a good enough excuse anyway to have lost your marbles. But tell us a bit about the Michael Owen.
It's just a signed jersey. But when I was young, he was the biggest footballer to me. I remember I used to get up and watch Michael Owen soccer school on a Saturday morning. I did project on him. I used to be obsessed with him. And it's pretty heartbreaking because he's incredibly boring now, and he's awful when he does punditry. So it's kind of tough to see that now. But as a footballer, all I used to do was try and emulate him with his little flick. And he was my go-to footballer at a young age.
Well, that's great stuff. So we're going to just take a short break and we'll be back to talk about all the pre-game rituals in the dressing room, some kicking competitions at Ulster, and John will answer some listeners' questions in the House of Rugby Hall of Fame.
House of Rugby Ireland. Tell us what you think by comment and rating us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify and Google Podcasts.
So welcome back to part 2, and we're going to start with the Guinness House of Rugby Hall of Fame. We asked our Facebook group if you had any good questions for John, and we had an avalanche of questions, and here are the top 3. The first one, what does John consider to be the best contributing attributes to the team or squad during game day? Asked by Peter English, a tough one to start with.
Yeah, it is. I'm probably, from earlier on in my career, I probably would have been one of those people bouncing around trying to get psyched up for games, but I've kind of gone the other way now, especially with kicking and stuff like that. I try to stay as relaxed as I can before the game. And it's funny because everyone comes around slapping your hand and stuff. And so I'm just sitting in my spot and like, okay, thanks. Good luck. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, thanks. Everyone's coming around and trying to relax my breathing and stuff like that. People like Al O'Connor will be jumping around cursing every 2 seconds. So there's two types of people I like to say with myself and watch kind of videos of Tiger Woods or Kobe Bryant. And then you've got people like Ian as well, getting everyone hyped up. He's a bit of a hype up merchant. So there's two types of people I find in the changing rooms. And I think Ian, before we played Leinster after lockdown, I remember coming in and for the first minute, everyone kind of just stays relaxed and waits for the coaches to come in and say stuff. And then the corner of my eye, I just see Ian jumping up, screaming, telling us to get ready to go again. I just remember it was like the elephant in the room after the game. But everyone's like, are we going to bring up Ian's halftime talk there? He had us all raring to go in the second half. So that's probably one of my fond memories recently.
Yeah, I love it. I love the pre-game stuff. I've tried different things throughout my career between being more relaxed there's definitely been times in my career that I've gone too far and I've been too pumped up. And, you know, I think as halfbacks, it's very important that we've got to be in control of our emotions and being able to think our way through a game, especially the first 5-10 minutes. It's, you know, so important that your team gets a foothold in the game. But I also still feel passionately that, you know, getting psyched up for a game, at the end of the day, you're going out into a full contact sport, is a huge part of it. And You know, I use that kind of last minute before we leave the change room to get my key messages across, you know, G the guys up, fill them up with confidence, and, you know, ultimately away we go. And that's a, it's a part of it that I've really grown to enjoy as the years have gone on in my career. You know, it's, it is a special time before you go out. Everyone's tense, everyone's nervous, and you're about to put it all on the line. And, you know, I like getting behind that.
I think coaches like to see, you know, that you're prepared as well, and that, like, you know, that you're getting ready for the game. And I have a really funny memory of when we played England, it was 2 years ago, 3 years ago, in Six Nations at home, and we were like singing Westlife songs on the way to Captain's Run, like blaring songs, and like going up and down the bus with a speaker. And we had a shock in Captain's Run, and we lost to England the next day, and like, it was nothing to do with our Captain's Run, like nothing to do with our Captain's Run and our Westlife fans. Like, you know, we just weren't good enough on the day, but we got slated for how we acted on the bus on the way to Captain's Run because we were singing songs. So from that day on, everyone now is like sitting in their own seats, earphones in, no sound. Like, and I always forget my earphones. And no one sits beside me on the bus. No one sits beside anybody on Captain's Run anymore. And I'm just looking around, but like, is anyone around that I can talk to? Like, is anyone up for the crack? Like, no one wants to talk because everyone's like scared shitless of getting eaten again, like we did that day against England. But I think it's important to have like a mix of Ian and a mix of you as well, John, for that. Yeah. But going to question number two.
Just on that one, we have a good one where basically the speaker is passed around within the team each week. So let's say John gets it this week, he gets to effectively pick the music for the week. So for some of our training sessions, we'd start off with a bit of music. And, you know, I've been in teams where the head coach would say, no music in the change room. If you want to listen to music, put your own headphones on. You're not going to be disrupting anyone else. And then there's other train of thoughts out there that, you know, say, look, there is something about everyone listening to the same stuff, bopping along. It can create a, you know, an atmosphere within us. And, you know, Ulster's been like that since I've arrived. But I remember playing Connacht away around Christmas time, and Tom O'Toole was looking after the music, and he just had the most head-wrecking music on before the game. And I was nervous. I was trying to go through the plays in my head, and it was just I just turn around and I go, Tom, change that fucking song. You know, and it was just like, but even that for me, it kind of made me realize, geez, I'm actually pretty nervy here. And like releasing it out on him definitely helped me. Like, so, and we had a good laugh about, you know, while we were doing our warm up. And it just, it does create a togetherness. And you can lose that with just everyone being on your headphones. It almost creates people being more on their phones, which saps the energy, and it's not something you want.
Yeah, absolutely agreed. Agreed. Question number two in our Guinness House of Rugby Hall of Fame is, my son plays for Terenure under 12s. We would love to hear John's advice on John's progress from playing for his home club Terenure Rugby to Leinster Rugby and beyond. And that's from Margaret Hall.
Oh, I know, Margaret. Hello. Yeah, Terenure is my local club, and I actually didn't start playing rugby till I was 12. So I played at soccer before that, and I was quite late to it. So so I can't really give them too much information about playing at a young age. But for me, I was quite lucky. I went to Gonzaga, and I didn't know how to pass off my left hand, so I used to invert it and pass off my right. But luckily, Gonzaga were pretty crap, so they put me on the A's at scrum half, and I just kind of stayed there for a couple of years. And yeah, I think it was just, for me, it was always just about, I was always competitive, so it was just about slightly getting better each year. And fifth year, I was on the bench and worked pretty hard that summer at trying to get a starting role for Gonzaga. As I said, they weren't even the best, so. For me, it was just probably that year when I was probably around 17 where I probably put in the most work I had, and out of nowhere, somehow I got a Leinster trial and kind of kicked on from there. So for me, it was just enjoying playing rugby and probably not putting yourself under too much pressure and kind of continuously practicing even your weaknesses. And I always like a good quote is like, work on your weaknesses until they become your strengths. So that was probably something I took at that age, was trying to get better at things I wasn't very good at.
I'm going to really look at your left hand pass now the next time you're playing, just to see if there's any inkling of that.
That's in the past. I can pass now.
I actually, I don't know, did I read an article or listen to a podcast with you before, and you spoke about how like you actually are pretty decent at soccer. Like, you did you have to make a decision to like choose rugby over soccer?
Well, I always get slagged from the lads because I always bring up soccer. I come from a football background, and they all like slagging me. They all abuse me for that because I've probably said it 50 times. I played for my local club, and I'd say at a young age you kind of have to make a decision early. But once I started playing rugby, I was playing that 5 times a week. So I just like playing on a Sunday with my mate. So I enjoyed that, and I played till I was 18. So I used to go from Leinster trials and then just drive straight over to football games straight after. But yeah, for me, I'd love to play even a year Sunday league when I retire. That would be my dream. I don't think I'll play rugby when I give up. I would only go play hell. I'll be straight to Sunday league up top playing striker. That would be my life goal now.
You won't, mate. You're playing cornerback. Your speed.
No, man. I don't pass. I'm a glory striker. Give me the ball.
I've seen John play soccer. He's very impressive. He's actually. What's the team that you support up here? Like the local team that play in the.
Corrine. I'm a show pony, yeah. Though. I'm a show pony. I'm good for a few tricks.
John told Corrine we're trying to sign him up. So that John had been to a few of their games and they gave him a jersey with Cooney 9 on the back. And he thought, like, geez, I could be getting a contract off the back of these guys.
I was honestly close to mention him during lockdown and be like, can I come train with you? Because I was training on my own. And like, I'd love to go and play.
It'd be brilliant.
Well, it's your lifelong goal. So hopefully you get to reach that goal at some stage. And the third question, who I think a lot of people are really eager to find out about this, is that myself included, actually, is you've got to ask him about the halftime race to beat Craig Casey off the pitch. I'd seriously like to hear his reasoning behind this from Len Carmody. You actually shared this on your story as well. So give us a bit of an insight into that.
Oh, I knew this coming up. I got a few messages from people thinking I had to run to the toilet, but that wasn't the case. Or sorry, the Casey, if they're going to put a pun in there. For me, yeah, it's just I'm a competitive individual and I just felt like having a race. I think I just felt like racing off the field for a bit of crack. I think I'd seen him play a few games and I knew he took a massive amount of confidence from being the first off the field at halftime. So I told myself for a bit of crack, I'll race him off. And I nearly forgot when I saw him go to run. I was on the far side of the field. I just kind of kicked in and started running by him and thought it was a bit of fun. I don't know. I am probably a bit of a lunatic, but I thought it was funny. And I had Jack Hardy messaging me within an hour after the game, being like, sent the video to me, being like, what the hell are you doing, you lunatic? but yeah, I'm sure he'll be brought up for a while. And if we're ever in Ireland camp together, I'm sure they'll enjoy trying it up. I just thought it'd be funny. Running a younger lad off the field just to show that I'm still a young pup.
We loved it anyway, Johnny. It was great.
I probably shouldn't have done it.
Oh, it's nice to see a different side of it.
I wasted all my energy. I had no energy left.
Well, cheers for that and cheers for the insight and answering all those questions. And Peter English, you are our House of Rugby Hall of Fame winner. So welcome to the Hall of Fame. So I suppose leading back into... going back into the superstitions and I suppose pre-game rituals. John, is there any like superstitions that you have prior to a game? Like, do you have to wear a certain type of boots or do you have to, you know, practice how many kicks before a game just to be ready? Like, what are your pre-game superstitions?
I actually probably wouldn't be superstitious at all. The only thing is my boots. I generally would wear boots that I'm used to wearing and ones I feel comfortable in. That Leinster game the other week, I went to tighten my stud and broke in the boots. So I had to wear a brand new pair of boots I'd never worn. So I was slightly nervous in the warm-up, but it actually went quite well for me. But I'd be very regimented with the day before every game. I'd always make sure I take 40 minutes, an hour going through the game. And something I'd be big into listening to podcasts. I took affirmations. I listened to a podcast a couple of years ago and the creator Dilbert and the importance of kind of affirmations and writing down what you want to do. And it's probably something in the last 3 years that I'm always do before games. And it's definitely given me more of a crossover between goals I set for games and actually completing them in games. Sometimes when I don't get them, I'll just dismiss it, saying that's not why. And when I do get them, that I'd put a lot of it down to that prep that I do before every game. And I'd sometimes even write the goal 50 to 60 times on the back pages of my book. And it's probably a slight insight into what I do before games, but it definitely makes a massive difference for me, and visualization of what I'm going to do, stuff like that. I find since I've done it, it's had a massive impact on my game.
Yeah, big time.
Do you have any superstitions?
No, I wouldn't be superstitious, but I'd be very process driven, similar to John. You know, I like going through the same routine the day before a game, the same routine the day of a game. Do a lot of rolling out, stretching, mental preparation, going through the game plan. I like to eat the same foods around game time, you know, spaghetti bolognese the night before, you know, Weetabix the morning of a game. It's just, you know, I don't want anything different in there that could potentially throw me. During my time in Bristol,
Would you cook that spaghetti bolognese yourself and everything, like, from scratch?
No, luckily I have Anna here, who's the head chef. I might do some of the chopping, but not before game night. She'd want me getting my rest, and she'd look after it all. She's brilliant, so I'm very lucky.
If you even attempted that chopping prior to a game, you'd probably lose a finger. So maybe just stay away from the preparation.
Yeah. Exactly. If anyone was watching the cooking during the week, you'd see that I don't have a clue what I'm doing. So maybe the next lockdown I might learn, but it hasn't happened yet. During my time in Bristol, we used to go to the stadium pretty early before games. Like, Pat would have us there, you know, nearly 4 or 5 hours before kickoff, and we'd eat as a team and then kind of go through our routine. And you know, during the 3 years there, I kind of became quite accustomed to it, and I saw the benefits of it. And when we're playing at home now and in Ravenhill, I like getting in there, you know, 3 or 4 hours beforehand, get in with the physios, get in with the masseuse, kind of go through my own movement preparation. And then I'll head over to the change room, and I like being there when guys are arriving. You know, I think it can set the tone for the evening. You know, if you're going in, or as lads are coming into the dressing room, if you're there set up and you're, you know, high energy and giving them a big high five and a hug, and you know, they are kind of builds their excitement. And I've grown to really love that process of it.
Yeah, that's great. It's really interesting, the process driven both of you are. Maybe that's just a decision maker or a 9 or 10 thing, but sports psychology is, I suppose, growing. And the more, you know, more we chat to athletes, the more we realize the importance of sports psychology. And John, particularly for you, you've had a few, you know, knocks along the way. It hasn't been plain sailing by any means. You know, your 2019 World Cup omission to come back and play great in the Six Nations, to almost start that French game that never went ahead, to not making that Autumn Nations team. How difficult was that to come back from? Like, what did you do to make yourself, I suppose, more resilient to bounce back from those disappointments?
Yeah, I think I've learned a lot through injuries. I think that kind of helped me a lot through resilience, and something I take. Probably the biggest thing I've learned as a rugby player just in life is studying other people. And for me, it's not really Irish sport, it's American sport. And I took a lot from Kobe Bryant, and there's another guy, Inky Johnson. And through my last shoulder surgery, he talks, when you get to a point where things get difficult, and if you're only doing it for yourself, eventually you're going to hit something harder than you and you're going to give up. So my family did a lot for me and stuff, and my girlfriend. So for me, that's something I kind of fall back on when I'm struggling. So the difference between that World Cup and probably not making the Six Nations recently was that, for me, after the World Cup, I really enjoy my company in Ulster. And it was easy for me to go back there because I love it there. And as disappointing it was to make the World Cup, I thought, okay, well, I'll go back to work with Ulster and things will be great. But what I found difficult recently was that with COVID, it's all up in the air, and games mightn't be going ahead, and going back to Ulster was just uncertain. And I'd be lying to say that the final didn't really upset me as well. So I was still disappointed from that. So it kind of was compounded by not making that Six Nations squad. So it was a couple of difficult months. And yeah, I probably went back to things I had practiced in the past and checked in with people that I probably used in the past as well. And it got to the point where I probably realized how fickle sport was, and that it can change so quickly. So for me, I I realised that I have to take a little bit of the emotion I was probably investing into rugby and into sport, and realising that, okay, well, it's just a game at the end of the day. And I think that kind of took the pressure off myself, and just kind of went back to Ulster and said, I'm just going to enjoy playing rugby and do what I can do well here. And that's probably what kind of got me out the other side of it and got me back playing good rugby.
So the stuff like competitions at Ulster, that kind of stuff kept you going, I imagine.
I don't even want to get into that. I've lost, I'd say, like 50 quid buying in donuts and coffee. So when he first came, I think I won the first one in the summer. And I was like, ah, happy days. And then after that, he's played me. He was like, okay, for now I'll put donut and coffees on it. I think I lost the next four or something. And he come over, we kicking, are we? I was like, no, I'm kicking on my own. Go away. So I haven't done a kicking competition with him since, because my confidence was too low.
Oh, brilliant. You've been kicking wild out, Johnny.
I just couldn't anywhere. I was like, I'm
different competition.
I know. So, get Mike Larry to step to up. He's usually good for it.
He knows how to play me. He was just picking his good spots and I was missing. I'd just be like, okay, go on. I'm kicking on my own here.
You need to choose your opponents wisely next time, John. Well, cheers to everyone for watching and listening. Don't forget, you can continue to get involved in our Facebook group and on Twitter. A big thank you to producer Pat, Paul, Dermot, Anthony, Paddy, and everyone that helped getting this show together. This has been House of Rugby Ireland here on Joe, together with Guinness. Slán go fóill.
Slán.
House of Rugby Ireland here on Joe, together with Guinness. Game changed.